You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Saturday, July 22nd, 2017, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. We were unable to record a full episode this week, unfortunately, because the Novella brothers' father passed away earlier this week. We'll give this a full discussion next week. Meanwhile, here is a previously unaired interview that we had conducted with Michael Mann. Well, we are here now at Nexus 2016 with Michael Mann. Michael, welcome back to The Skeptic's Guide.
Oh, thanks. It's great to be with you.
It's been a couple of years. We first interviewed you, I think, 2 years ago at TAM. And, of course, you are a climate scientist. You're, in many ways, you're the climate scientist. You're the hockey stick guy. I know you're not the climate scientist, but...
James Hansen would probably take issue with that.
But I think you are, I think because you came first wanted to come up with the hockey stick kind of increase in temperature data in the industrial age, you're a flashpoint, I would say that's fair, for a lot of the climate change deniers. In fact, I'm currently engaged on my blog with climate change deniers in the comments section, and you come up. You're the one climate scientist who comes up. They're calling you a fraud, by the way.
You're a household name.
The point is, though, that, I mean, you still are sort of the focal point of climate change denial. I mean, do you think that's a fair statement?
Well, I'm one of a number of climate scientists who have been targeted by climate change deniers because, you know, our work has played a prominent role in the larger public discourse on climate change. And so the hockey stick, this curve we published a decade and a half ago, became this icon in the climate change debate. And so critics looking to try to discredit the science have gone after sort of the iconic aspects of the science, and the hockey stick being one of them. And unfortunately, you know, the method of attack that's preferred is the ad hominem attack. Mm-hmm. So to discredit the hockey stick, the easiest thing to do is to try to discredit me personally. And it's something that, you know, I've dealt with now for a decade and a half. Ironically, the attacks against me sort of raise my profile to the point where I have much more influence and much more access to the media and much more of an opportunity to contribute to this very important discussion.
You think it's a net positive then? So the positives outweigh the negatives?
By far. Okay, wow. Yep. I mean, because, you know, the climate change deniers are sort of an echo chamber. And, yeah, they can fill up the comment sections of blogs. And they can. There's a lot that they do to try to make it sound like they are a far larger proportion of the public than they really are. But they are a fringe. They're a minority. In the end, you know, the folks that I think most of us as communicators are targeting are the folks in the middle, honest people who are confused because they hear from the critics that the climate the science is all a myth, and
it's all rigged.
Scientists trying to get rich off of grant money, et cetera, et cetera. There are hundreds of talking points that they use, and there are honest people who caught in between who hear that who genuinely think that there must be some controversy and aren't aware of the fact that in reality, there's a very strong scientific consensus on the basics of climate change. And so my efforts, and I think the efforts of a lot of us, are really to target those folks who are confused. We're not going to move. You know, there's the fringe, 15 to 20%, the folks you're talking about who are very proactive in their attacks on the science, and they're very effective at filling the comment sections of blogs and making it seem like they are, again, a much larger proportion of the public than they are. And they're immune to information and efforts to, in general, I wouldn't dismiss all of them, but by and large, my experience is that they're not even really thinking about this as a scientific issue. To them, it's ideological,
emotional,
and it's very difficult to cut through that with facts and logic and reasoning. I think our efforts are best targeted at the honest folks in the middle who are a much larger proportion of the public, those folks who are confused. And if your ultimate aim is for us to act meaningfully based on our scientific understanding to do something about climate change, you don't need that fringe, that 15 to 20%. You're probably never going to get them, and you're going to waste a lot of your time and effort and precious resources trying to do so when they would have been much better spent Again, sort of with those honestly confused folks in the middle.
Well, you say that it's fringe and commenters, and to a large extent, I agree, but you also have an entire political party that disagrees with it.
That's absolutely
a different kettle of fish.
And it's remarkable, isn't it, right? Where you can have, you know, maybe only, and the latest polling suggests it's somewhere in the range of 75% of the American electorate recognizes that climate change is real and it's happening and it's human caused. Pretty much at all time highs, and that's not surprising because we're breaking temperature records year after year, and that really does penetrate into the public consciousness. And so how is it that we can have such an overwhelming percentage of the public who's actually on the side of science, and yet have our politics controlled by a party where virtually 100% of them, not quite 100%, there's still folks in the Republican Party who do accept the science. They've been really quiet because they're afraid of, you know, sure, facing a primary challenge. If they speak up about it, they're afraid of being primaried by the Koch brothers. So they're pretty quiet. There are some in the Republican Party who are on the right side of the science. And I think what you will see, if we get the sort of realignment that some people think could happen in the wake of this next election, realignment of the parties, the silver lining, if Donald Trump takes the Republican Party off the cliff, which it increasingly looks like he might, the silver lining, in my view, is that it will create an opening for the moderates within the party who have wanted to have an honest discussion about climate change and what to do about it, and who want conservative principles to be part of the policy discussion, right? Because right, that's what we should. That's a legitimate argument to have.
Right, exactly. Economics.
Absolutely.
It's definitely part of this.
And there are, you know, Republicans, conservative Republicans like Bob Inglis, who's a congressman from South Carolina. He got primaried out of his seat, even though he had a near 100% perfect lifetime conservative voting record, because he had actually spoken out about needing to do something about climate change. He faced a primary challenge. Guy, Trey Gowdy, who's heading up the Benghazi hearings.
Yeah.
He was heavily financed by the Koch brothers, primaried Bob Inglis. Bob Inglis now travels around the country trying to convince his fellow conservatives that there are ways to deal with this problem in the context of the free market, and conservatives need to be part of this important discussion.
Mm-hmm, sure.
So that's a good sign to me. It means that it's out there. And in the right political environment, there will be room for the Bob Inglises of the world and the Lindsey Grahams and the John McCains and all the in-the-closet, climate-wise, Republicans who would like to have a worthy conversation about what to do.
And if I remember correctly, I know it always matters how you ask these questions, but a recent survey showed that like 60% of Republicans are concerned about climate change.
That's right.
It's not just... It's not a majority even of that party. It really is a minority in the one party. And then, of course, the party itself is not a majority of Americans. Independent is the largest group.
Correct.
Yes, it is.
It is. Wow. So, about 30-40 is the split.
Yeah, so it's like 40% of 30% are really the climate change deniers.
And I know the independents are the folks who feel like, you know, many of them, the Republican Party of today has left them behind.
Absolutely.
Sure.
Absolutely.
And,
sure,
you know, they would have been Republicans, in the Reagan years and before.
Mm-hmm.
And then the irony, of course, is that when you look at Reagan, you look at George H.W. Bush, some of the great successes in dealing with global environmental problems happened under their watch.
Mm-hmm.
Richard Nixon actually founded the EPA.
Mm-hmm.
You had George H.W. Bush acted on acid rain. Reagan acted on ozone depletion. Each of them had very good EPA administrators who took these problems very seriously. That's the Republican Party that we need to see more.
So where was the turning point then? Can we point to something that said, okay, at this time of this date, this event happened, and that philosophically sort of changed the mind?
There's so many Fox News factors, like Fox News, for example.
So changing media
that completely changed the conversation, like, the Drudge Report and talk radio. I think they've driven like the core to the Tea Party, to the far right, it seems. And then,
well, I sound like a broken record when I say Koch brothers really did almost single-handedly, they took hold of that party, and they purged the party of moderates by financing primary campaigns to get rid of the moderates. There are no New England Republicans left.
That's right.
The moderate Republicans. We can't ignore, that changing landscape due in part to conservative foundations who've created, literally manufactured out of whole cloth, the Tea Party movement. Now what they realize is that they can't control this angry beast that they've created.
Yeah, exactly.
So
question for you. So, because a lot of people, politics is in the forefront. A lot of people are talking about it. Even if we had a party that won the election and the government was completely behind trying to fund and help the global warming issue, isn't it too late?
No, and clearly I failed in my talk earlier to convince people that it isn't too late. It's too late to prevent certain things from happening. We're committed to a certain amount of additional warming no matter what we do, and that's just because of the thermal inertia of the climate system. The oceans will continue to warm up for decades in the future. The best estimates, though, are that we could still avoid crossing one fairly critical threshold, 2 degrees Celsius, 3.6 Fahrenheit warming of the planet relative to pre-industrial. There really is no magic number, but if you're looking for some consensus as to when we really start to cross into the danger zone of climate change impacts, many people feel that 2 degrees Celsius is about as good a number as possible. We can still stabilize warming below that point. In Paris, the agreement that was reached is an agreement to cut emissions enough to reduce warming by about 50% from what it would otherwise be. Still not enough to get us below 2 degrees Celsius, so there's no doubt there's still work to be done. But as I said in my talk, we are turning the corner. We've got to turn the corner even faster.
I'm glad you brought up Paris, because obviously it brings the global context of all of this into play. America needs to do its part. We're obviously the largest industrial power in the world. But there are other players on the table as well. China and India come to mind. What are the steps we can do to help convince those nations to get on the right track with this? They seem to be dragging their heels.
Yeah, well, there's sort of a fallacy, a mythology that many of us fall victim to. The best intentioned and most informed people still fall victim to, because the media hasn't really done as good a job at conveying sort of the state of the playing field as they could be doing. And there's no more dramatic example of that than China. Because it is true that, say 5 years ago, China was, building a coal-fired power plant every 5 days. Their greenhouse gas emissions were escalating. But now, if you look at where we are, they're spending a whole lot more money on renewable energy technology than we are in the U.S. Mm-hmm. They have actually exceeded the expectations. There was this recent agreement between the U.S. and China last year to lower carbon emissions. China is lowering their emissions even faster than what they committed to in that agreement. They are decommissioning coal-fired power plants.
Wow, that's fantastic.
It's remarkable, because they see firsthand, they understand the impacts of environmental pollution, Beijing. You can barely breathe in Beijing half the time. So they understand firsthand that this is, if they don't act on this problem, they suffer as much as anybody. Yep. And so ironically, it may be that we have to look to China now. The U.S. needs to look to China for leadership, because they're, by some measures, doing more than we are. The fact that solar panels have come down by 80% in cost is because of mass production by China. They've literally flooded the global marketplace. So we now have cheap solar panels. We're a global economy now. And when one country, invests in basic, research and development, the rest of us benefit from it. That's sort of a clue to us that we should really jump on the bandwagon, be part of the solution rather than the problem. We're falling behind in our global economic competitiveness because we're letting countries like China now move ahead in the direction that we all know the world is going towards, a renewable energy economy.
Now, I'd like to give our listeners some things to think about, almost like a prime directive. So what should we be doing? What can we do as the individual? As an example, do we answer the phone when the solar power companies call us and want us to put solar panels on our roof and all that? What do we do?
So, we should do all those things. I call them no regrets. I call them low-hanging fruit or negative cost actions, where there are things that we can do that make us healthier, like bicycling rather than driving, that save us money, more fuel-efficient vehicles, more efficient appliances. So we ought to be doing these things anyways, and if we do them, we cut our carbon emissions. There are all these voluntary actions that we can do. First of all, that cut our carbon emissions. Then, if you want to do a little more, you can pay a little bit more for your power, as we do, and make sure that it comes from renewables. So we get all of our power from wind, and there's a plan that allows us to do that in Pennsylvania. Other people install solar panels. I have a hybrid vehicle. I'm sort of trying to do what I can do personally, because I think personal responsibility is an important part of this. But we also understand, and economists have long understood, that if you want to see sort of a mass change in behavior, you have to incentivize it in the economy. Mm-hmm. And so ultimately, we need some incentive for people to collectively do what they need to be doing anyway. And that means you need a market signal. You need to somehow price this externality, the fact that carbon emissions are damaging the planet, but that's not incorporated in the price that you pay at the pump or what you pay for your electricity. If it were incorporated, then suddenly the playing field would be leveled. The solar, renewable, these other technologies that aren't having the same damage would be far more competitive. The amazing thing is they're approaching market parity even without that
even
incentive.
Without, yeah.
but too slowly. We need to accelerate that process.
Yeah. Well, in some cases, they're already beyond it. In some markets, solar power is actually cheaper.
Yeah. Now, there are issues. You know, people will talk about energy density and intermittency. There are other factors that come in where there's an advantage right now in that the grid isn't adaptive enough to allow you to just power things off of renewables. But that's what we need to invest in a smart grid, right, so that we can... Yeah.
So a related question, if this is beyond your area of expertise, let me know. Do you think we need nuclear in order to turn the corner fast enough?
I'm unconvinced. I'm a bit of an agnostic, a nuclear agnostic. I'm unconvinced just because the investment time scale is so long. A nuclear power plant, it doesn't really pay off until about 50 years. So if you're talking about nuclear as this bridge strategy to get us to a fossil fuel free future, where, you know, most estimates are that just given the economies of scale that are already taking place with renewables, in a few decades, we will be able to power the grid entirely from renewable energy. But that means we need a bridge because we can't emit that much more carbon in the meantime. So we've got to find some bridge technology that gets us to that. And some people say, well, natural gas. I'm convinced of that. Natural gas is still a fossil fuel and it actually releases a lot of methane, which is a potent greenhouse gas. Some people say nuclear, but nuclear isn't a short-term strategy. It's a long-term investment. And if you're, a conservative who's against sort of government subsidies, then you should hate nuclear because it's not viable without huge government investment. Mm-hmm. So I remain unconvinced, but I think it should be on the table. I think that's part of the discussion that we need to be having, right, in the U.S. Congress, rather than is climate change a hoax?
Right.
Which scientists can we investigate next?
All right, so to get back to my question, though, so what about if we buy electric cars? Right, Tesla's coming out with their car in 18 months. If we buy an electric car, is the electricity being generated by burning fossil fuels, or by the time these technologies come out, are these going to be good things for us to do?
Yeah, so that's a great question. So I think even, given a primarily fossil fuel driven grid, there's still some efficiencies in an electric vehicle. So you still gain something. But ultimately, if we're going to, get ourselves entirely off of fossil fuels, then the grid that we're using to charge our vehicles has to be non-fossil fuel energy based. Mm-hmm. And that's, I think that we're already well along the trajectory towards that being the case. But again, we have to make that happen even faster. So once we have a renewable energy based grid, then our transportation sector is powered by renewable energy. Then our power sector is powered, obviously, by renewable energy. One of the outstanding complications, one of the greatest challenges will be aviation.
Yes.
Because...
hard to get around that one. Yeah.
Well, it is. You need, maybe we need, for example, biofuels that have sufficient energy density for that sort of, intensive, energy, usage.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There's so many things that are epically convenient about liquid fuel. Yeah. Because it's energy dense, super easy to refill.
Right.
There's all those things about it. Like, you can't do that with electricity. The batteries, a plane did just do like a global flight But it probably, well, you know, we're down to the pound.
Yeah, right. Only one person.
Yeah.
Right, yeah, you can imagine. Each person will be allowed to bring one small bag.
Toothbrush.
Toothbrush.
I want to get back to the tipping point thing, too, because that's a question we get a lot, and it's one of those things that I hear like a range of answers about. I think maybe because the projections are literally a range of possibilities. And related to that is, it seems like our goal right now is to reduce the rate of increase of our CO2 production, or maybe stabilize or even decrease our CO2 release. But isn't that still increasing the net amount of CO2, extra CO2 in the atmosphere? It's kind of like reducing the deficit. It's not really touching the debt. Don't we have to start to like have negative CO2 in order to really, you know, prevent the worst outcomes of global climate change?
Yeah, so there's a lot of confusion out there about the distinction, for example, between CO2 concentrations and CO2 emissions. So concentrations are the integral of the emissions, right? So it's the curve. If you integrate that curve, you know, so every time you emit molecule of CO2 into the atmosphere, you're increasing the concentration. You can be bringing your emissions down, but you're still emitting.
Yeah.
So it turns out that's the challenge we face. If we want to bring CO2, if we want to prevent it, you know, from crossing that 450 level, then you've got a pretty steep emissions curve. You've got to bring emissions down fairly rapidly. And if you do the math, to avoid crossing 450 parts per million CO2 in the atmosphere, pre-industrial levels were about 280. We've now passed 400, well on our way to 450 at current rates of fossil fuel burning. We passed 450 in a couple decades. So if you do the math, in order to prevent us from crossing 450 ppm CO2 in the atmosphere, the emissions curve has to come down by several percent a year and be at roughly, you know, 20% of late 1990s emissions by the middle of the century.
So how do we manifest that? Like, what would have to happen to get there?
Before that question, but even if we get it down to 20%, aren't we still emitting? And won't we eventually cross that 450?
Well, that's a mid-century. And then the assumption is that curve continues
to asymptotically.
It doesn't have to go to zero because there's some amount of natural uptake of CO2.
Okay. That was part of my question.
Yeah. So, but what the good news, and again, you know, I've been emphasizing that there is some good news here, is that we've seen that emissions curve seems to have peaked.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't think we were going to see it that soon, but global emissions remained unchanged in 2013, and then they came down slightly in 2014. And, you know, some people would be tempted to say, oh, well, that must mean, you know, just because the economy did worse. No. Global domestic product increased.
That's despite
both of those years.
Yeah.
So we're seeing we're seeing sort of a decarbonization of our economy.
What caused that?
The things that you might think would cause it. The fact that a lot of countries are really going whole hog on renewable energy. Germany recently, you know, on a sunny day is getting 50% of their power from renewables.
Yeah.
On average, they're getting about 30%. England just last week, 2 days in a row where they got where they didn't burn any coal. Basically,
wow.
It was almost all renewable energy. And so we're already seeing hints of where we can be. Even given existing technologies, simply scaling up the existing technology. But as we all know, we are going to find all sorts of efficiencies as we continue to innovate and research and develop.
I recently learned, maybe a year ago, that our cement industry produces a lot of, like 20% of our CO2. Some significant, nothing to do with energy production, just in the process of making cement, it releases massive amounts of CO2. Anyone looking at solutions to that problem?
Yeah, so I mean, and that is the challenge, right? Literally just about everything we do generates CO2. So we tend to think a lot about transportation and power, but if you look at the pie chart, there are, you know, six or seven big chunks
farming,
of pie.
Farming.
Absolutely. Agriculture, livestock, sort of food patterns, our eating habits. It's a lot more friendly to the climate to be a vegetarian than to eat meat, just because of the resource.
Oh,
you know,
boy.
Yeah.
Damn.
We need that lab-grown meat fast.
Well, you know, and there's some, again, there's a lot of low-hanging fruit. So those of us who like to have a steak every once in a while, we're still going to do that. And, you know, we can... you know, we target the easy stuff first. And ultimately, there will be ways to address some of the more challenging aspects of our sort of carbon footprint. And that has to do with food, because we all, you know, you like what you like. You want to eat what you want to eat. There, you know, as we said, aviation is a challenge. There is, you know, land use, just development. As you said, manufacturing, industry is a pretty big chunk. It's about 18-20%. A lot of that, you know, is cement production. So just about everything. And so there is no magic bullet, right, to solve the problem. We've got to target a whole bunch of...
Everything has to be brought into the
game.
But, you know, there are some, there, like I said, there's some low-hanging fruit in targeting the power sector and the transportation sector. That's going to make a big difference. That's where a lot of the growth has been, frankly.
It's interesting to think that if we buy a few devices for our home that are low energy, turn off lights more, possibly buy an electric car.
LED lights are huge.
LED lights. Just, yeah, our brother
my
Joe.
All lights in the house with LEDs, every light.
Our brother Joe is a energy specialist. He installs heating and air conditioning, total green technology. And he's saying that even before you buy the hardware, just making sure that your home has the right R factor so it retains its coolness and its heatness when you want it to, is that's like 50% of the job right there. That's huge.
Well, and that's what, I mean, we talk about, you know, this issue about, you know, acting on climate change is going to destroy the economy. No, it's going to create all sorts of huge opportunities. And you just, you know, home audits, energy auditing, it's a new industry, and that, and we're going to need that in order to be able to implement these strategies. You guys probably know our good friend Bill Nye. Had this very friendly competition. Now he's sort of moved to New York, but when he was living primarily in L.A., his next door neighbor is Ed Begley Jr., the actor.
Wow. He was doing all this stuff 25 years ago.
Oh, Ed is amazing. I mean, he walks the walk. And they had this friendly competition to see who could lower their carbon footprint more, which is really cool. And Ed had this show, Ed and me, you know, about sort of what he does to try to achieve this. And I know, I'm not sure about Bill, but by the time he was done, Ed was using negative power. He was selling back to the grid. He was manufacturing through solar panels less than he actually needed.
I'm really close to getting solar panels for my house.
I'm looking at it now. I need an energy audit before. In Connecticut, you have to have an energy audit before they will sell you.
Let's get our brother to do the audit.
It makes sense at some level. Let's go first for conservation. There's a lot of reductions we can achieve through conservation.
Huge, total sense.
Huge deductions just from that. It looks like there's some good news here that I wasn't aware of. Still some bad news. We're not sure really where it's going to go. What about kind of really just covering our bases? And I don't hear it much lately, but the talk of mega scale engineering products for like a worst case scenario, like holy crap, we need to do something bad. Let's try this big, scary thing.
Right.
Are people still talking about that?
I mean, what could possibly go wrong, right?
What's the big, scary thing, though?
I talked a little bit about, you know, geoengineering, and there are these elaborate schemes that involve things like, you know, we know volcanic eruptions cool the planet for several years. It's because of these sulfur, you know, dioxide emissions. It produces these sulfate particles in the stratosphere, and they lie there for several years reflecting back a certain amount of sunlight. So if you do the calculation, if we could do the equivalent of creating a Mount Pinatubo-like eruption, the 1991 eruption in the Philippines, every few years, that would be enough of a cooling effect to offset global warming. And so those calculations spurred some of these geoengineering schemes, which you know, involve, for example, literally using giant cannons and firing huge amounts of these particles up into the stratosphere. And if you do the calculations, we could do it. We could put enough up there to, you know, do the equivalent of a Mount Pinatubo-like eruption every 2 to 3 years, enough to offset global warming.
No, I say we do it exactly like the way chemtrails happen. just to stick it to those bastards.
Oh, yeah, let's not even get to chemtrails. those are contrails. It's actually moisture coming out of the back of the plane. It's not chemicals.
But what's the downside to that? That we would get poisoned or something?
So the law of unintended consequences yes. reign supreme when you start talking. And I liken it, what I love to, you know, refer people, and I think most of us are the generation, we remember that song when we were growing up, there was an old lady who swallowed a fly.
Oh, yes, I don't know.
She
yes.
swallowed the frog.
I always love that song.
Yeah, and it's a it's a parabole for, you know, for geoengineering, in my view, because what killed her in the end?
It was the horse.
It was the geoengineering solution to the problem. Yeah. The problem was just a fly. She started out with the fly. So to me, it's the law of unintended consequences. And many of these schemes, and let's just take one of them, the sulfate particle geoengineering, shooting these particles up into the stratosphere. So it turns out we know quite a bit from, you know, what studying the response to volcanic eruptions. When you do that, first of all, the pattern of cooling you get spatially doesn't look like the reverse of the pattern of global warming. So even though in the global average they cancel mm-hmm. out, regionally they don't. So some regions would actually warm even faster. Some regions would cool. In the global average, you might get a zero sum. But you would get large climate changes regionally, very abrupt, substantial climate changes, very quickly. If you do the calculations, you find that you would actually probably slow down the hydrological cycle over land. So it'd be less rainfall over mm-hmm. the land regions. It would make drought worse. It would worsen ozone depletion. It would worsen acid rain. And if you had and CO2 would be continuing to build up in the atmosphere as we do that. The CO2 is there for posterity. It's there for hundreds, even thousands of years. So what happens if there is some sort of war, something happens, and that geoengineering technology, that regularly scheduled injection, that schedule is stalled, then we would get abrupt climate change unlike anything the Earth has seen since the KT impact. Most likely.
Oh boy, that's not the way.
Well, yeah. No, the dinosaurs didn't fare well, and there was a song by the Police, "Walking in Your Footsteps," which was basically about that.
What about carbon scrubbing? Can't we just have filters that suck it out or filter out carbon dioxide?
It's funny you mentioned that. I was actually on Bill Maher a year ago, and Bill, the interview at the beginning of the show, and he said, "We just need to create this giant sucking machine." I said, doesn't Dyson make that?
Yeah.
And that actually, in my view, is the one viable geoengineering strategy. And it wouldn't actually be a giant sucking machine, but what it would be is the deployment of a network of...
You may call nanobots.
We wish. We're not doing that.
That's what I'm waiting for.
Like, what was the movie with Johnny Depp with the nanobots?
And, yeah. I had some cool stuff in that movie. Dyson and... Bring it back and transcendence.
Transcendence, very relevant to some of the some of the discussions we've had here at Nexus. The fact is that you can, so trees do this. Trees take in CO2 and they bury it in the root systems. And mm-hmm. The problem is they're very inefficient in doing that and removing CO2 from the atmosphere, both at the collection level and when they die, and there's decomposition, some of the carbon makes it back up into the atmosphere. So the idea is to create these super trees. They're a million times more efficient at absorbing CO2 from the atmosphere than a tree, and perfectly efficient in burying it, because you take turn it into calcium carbonate, you react it with other stuff to make rock, and you bury it. And there was a guy actually here at Columbia University, Klaus Lochner, who sort of had popularized this technology and even sort of demonstrated through proof of concept that it could be done. The only problem, and he did the calculation, if we deployed millions of these, we could make a big dent in the problem.
The problem was that they would turn into tree ants and then take over the world, right?
Well, exactly. We've all seen The Matrix, so we know how this story turns out. But, the real problem is that right now, you're fighting the laws of thermodynamics in a sense, right? Because you're trying to take a very diffuse CO2 in the atmosphere and concentrate it. So it's energetically very expensive, and it's monetarily expensive. It turns out, there's some debate about the cost, but if this were deployed at the large scale, it might cost as much as $500 per ton of CO2 buried. And that's just a huge amount compared to all the other things that we can do much more cheaply. And so if it became an emergency, if we needed to lower CO2 dramatically, then eventually You know, especially as the price of this comes down, and Lochner claims he could get it down to $30 a ton. And if he could get it down to $30 a ton, then it's in the game.
Yeah. Are these genetically modified trees?
There isn't even any genetics. They're all inorganic.
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
Okay, they're not living trees. They're technological trees.
They are structures.
They're structures.
Oh, okay. Structures.
Sorry,
I should. Tree was a metaphor.
It was a metaphor.
That's cool. I got your metaphor. I got it.
Maybe it was a simile. I'm not sure. It was a simile or a metaphor.
I understood.
I know this is very new technology, but along those lines, there's a paper maybe 6 months ago where as a proof of concept, they were able to make carbon nanotubes out of carbon from the atmosphere. I don't know if you saw that, but imagine scaling that up to like we're producing, you know, millions of tons of carbon-based stuff, and that carbon is ultimately being drawn out of the atmosphere, like, you know, basically fighting one industry with another industry. That kind of thing can happen?
No, that argument has been made that, you know, like sequester right now is expensive to capture and sequester carbon. But you know, if we want to continue burning coal, almost certainly we would have to do that. And that currently would render, you know, coal obsolete because they can't deploy the technology necessary to do that at a cost that allows them to compete in the energy marketplace. But if they could do that, one of the things that's been argued is, well, maybe part of what could make that competitive is if there's stuff we could do with that captured carbon.
And it's built
exactly
stuff
as you say. Now, if you, the numbers don't necessarily work out. You're collecting a lot of carbon. And probably the amount that you could actually usefully convert into devices and sold in the market would be small.
Why?
Just because it's just an immense. We're adding right now about 10 gigatons, 10 billion tons of carbon to the atmosphere a year. It's just you do the calculation, the amount that you. That's why, like these quote unquote super trees, you literally need millions of them.
Oh, wow.
It's a major.
With each one being equivalent to a million trees.
That's right. That's right.
So yeah, okay, but that's
10^6 times 10 to the, you know, the numbers
right.
are.
Gigatons is obviously huge, but I wonder how much stuff are we making out of plastic, let's say? How many tons is that? And what if we were making all the stuff that we're currently making out of plastic, or a lot of it, out of carbon that we pulled from the atmosphere? This is purely hypothetical technology.
Can you
many gigatons of plastic crap do we make a year? I don't know.
Well, enough that contributes. Manufacturing contributes to our carbon emissions.
Yes. But imagine if we reversed it.
Yeah. So I think that's something that people are definitely looking into.
Yeah.
And it's not something to be dismissed out of hand, in my view.
Yeah, it's not crazy.
No.
I doubt that kind of thing is going to scale up in time to be a solution.
That's the problem.
Yeah.
The numbers just don't work out.
Yeah.
But it can help make, you know, certain, some of these efforts more competitive. Sequestration. Yeah.
If we're imagining what's our global civilization going to be like in 2100, you know, where's our energy coming from, et cetera, et cetera. All the sources of carbon, and we think if we want it really to be absolutely balanced, you know, zero, like a totally indefinitely sustainable, we also have to be, whatever carbon we're putting in, we have to be pulling out, right? So mm-hmm. you have to be thinking about technologies on both ends.
What if we kind of put this into perspective, and I haven't heard this in a while. Give me a worst case scenario. We screw up. We don't do what we need to do. What is a worst case scenario in terms of climate change? What are we trying to avoid here? Why is this so important?
Picture Charlton Heston.
Damn you.
No, it could be any one of at least three Charlton Heston movies.
Right.
Yes, right.
Could be Omega Man. It could be zombies.
Soylent Green.
So these slow moving or fast moving zombies?
I think. Slow, please. Please, you want a chance.
Right, it was the Will Smith remake.
Yes.
They became fast moving.
Like vampires, really, and impressed.
Yeah.
Well, they were never slow. Even in the original Omega Man, they were not even.
Oh, they were like just regular.
They were just sick people.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah, that's right.
They had the white hair.
The remake, they were like superhuman. They were like vampire speed.
Yeah. But I mean, the serious point is that. You know, worst case scenario, if you read some of the reports that have been done by the, you know, national security, community, and you read some of the scenarios that they're talking about, because they have to plan out worst case scenarios. And those scenarios do not sound that unlike, you know, some of the post-apocalyptic visions that Hollywood has provided us.
Waterworld?
Well, water, the numbers don't work out for water. Yeah. We can't melt that much ice. Yeah. That can't happen. But, I mean, you know, actually, to Charlton Heston's credit, one of the earliest movies to depict a post-apocalyptic global warming-caused world...
Soylent Green.
Yes, Soylent Green. If you watch the beginning of it, it's explicit. It was about global warming, and that was extremely prescient. Because that's 1973, I think. Mm-hmm. And it was before there was nearly the consensus that that would emerge later.
Yeah.
So, you know, Charlton Heston is sort of a green hero in popularizing global warming.
That was more about overpopulation.
It was that too.
It's the triggering effect is because there's a decrease in food production because they've killed off the oceans they're eating people.
So everybody listening to this show, please think about it. Please try to do something. We talked about some things that you can do here. Educate yourself. Yeah, I mean, I think we all, you know, most of the people that listen to the show are fans of these types of movies and have a really clear picture of what we're talking about. But all of us, everybody needs to get involved.
Absolutely. And voting is so important because this next election, I think, is going to be a pivotal election as far as us acting on climate change is concerned. We couldn't have a starker choice than is before us. And so that's really important because if we want to see policy at the highest level, and that's what we need policies that will incentivize the shift away from fossil fuel energy. We need leadership at the highest level in our politics, and we need policymakers who will reflect our needs rather than the needs of special interests who fund their campaigns.
At the very least, they need to acknowledge that it's happening.
That's the first stage, right? Is acceptance.
That's right. Yeah. So we have 20 years to fix the problem, not to decide to fix the problem.
Yeah, we have to. The good news is we are already implementing the solution. We're already seeing a transition.
And the proofs of concept are playing out. We're seeing that they work.
So we just need to do much more of what we're already starting to do. Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, the cool thing is we're seeing that it will work if we do it.
Yeah.
That's my takeaway.
That's the good news. Our destiny is still within our hands.
Yeah. Michael Mann, thank you so much for joining us. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you, guys. It was great.
Thank you, Michael.
The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at theskepticsguide.org, where you will find the show notes as well as links to our blogs, videos, online forum, and other content. You can send us feedback or questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. Also, please consider supporting the SGU by visiting the store page on our website, where you will find merchandise, premium content, and subscription information. Our listeners are what make SGU possible.